This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A couple of weeks ago, we presented a live concert with singer and songwriter Arthur Alexander. The concert was great, but there was hardly time to talk, so we made him promise to come back for an interview, the interview you're about to hear. Arthur Alexander is performing again after a nearly 20-year absence from the music scene. He's been living in Cleveland, driving a bus for a community center. Elektra Records recently coaxed him back into the studio. His new album, Lonely Just Like Me, reunites him with some of the musicians he recorded with in the 60s from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and Memphis.
There was a little girl I had planned to marry. This was my love. I didn't want to share it. I thought that love would make my life bright and sunny. She said she couldn't love me cause I didn't have no money. So every day I have to cry some. Every day I have to cry some. Dry the water from my eyes some. Every day I have to cry.
Arthur Alexander started recording in the early 60s in Alabama. He had some R&B hits in the States. In England, his fans included the Beatles, who recorded his song Anna, and the Rolling Stones, who did his song You Better Move On. Let's compare both versions of You Better Move On.
You asked me to give up the hand of the girl I love. You tell me I'm not the man she's worthy of. You ask me to give up the hand of the girl I love. You tell me I'm not the man she's worthy of.
Arthur Alexander, do you remember the first time you heard the Rolling Stones version of your song?
I sure do.
When was it, and what did you think?
It was back in 62, I think, or 63. The record had been out for quite some time before I heard it. But when I did hear it, well, I thought, you know, it's a great, a great tribute, you know, and follow-up to what I had done. And looked like, you know, he was following me as close as he could, you know. And he didn't sound bad, you know.
Were you surprised how famous they became?
I sure was.
Now, your version of You Better Move On, this was one of the first sessions that was cut at the Muscle Shoals studio, the Fame studio in Alabama. And it became one of the most famous Southern Soul studios. I think featured on that very first session at Muscle Shoals, in which you made You Better Move On, were some of the same musicians on your new record.
That's right.
Donny Fritz, Spooner Oldham.
That's right.
Now, how did you come to make the first record at that now famous studio?
Tom Stafford, which you may have heard or you may not have heard of, he was sort of the catalyst for everybody, you know, including Rick Hall, who produced the record. And his father had a drugstore. And above the drugstore, he had a studio. And all the musicians from miles around, you know, they would gather there in that studio, you know, that Tom had. And how I came to cut You Better Move On at Fame, before then, we'd done a song called Sally Sue Brown, and which it didn't do well. And then I wrote You Better Move On. And I took it to Tom and Rick. And they liked it, and they came to the conclusion that the studio that we had previously recorded Sally Sue Brown in was not adequate because it was only 2-track. So we moved up to 4-track, Ampex, and Rick went out and rented a tobacco barn in Muscle Shoals, and me, Donnie, and Spooner, and everybody. We went out and we burlapped the walls. We put egg crates around it. We coned it, you know, for the sound. And we went to work trying to record You Better Move On.
So it's really a historic session both for you and for the studio.
That's right.
Now, on the flip side of You Better Move On was another one of your songs called A Shot of Rhythm and Blues.
Right.
Now, I want to play it because I think the beginning is going to sound familiar even to people who don't know the recording. And then we'll segue into the reason why. Did the Beatles get that opening lick off of your record?
Well, you would think so, you know. I wouldn't go as far as to say that they did, but, you know, by listening to it, you know, you get a pretty good similarity, you know, to both records there. So I would, you know, if they did, it wouldn't be nothing irregular because during that time, a lot of people copied a lot of people, including me. I copied a lot of people.
Who'd you copy?
Well, I copied Brooke Benton on Sally Sue Brown, a lick that he had on Kitty-O, you know?
Uh-huh. Now, on the same record that the Beatles used that opening from, I Saw Her Standing There, they covered your song, Anna. Now, I want to play your version of Anna and then the Beatles cover of your song, Anna. We'll play them back to back.
Anna, you come and ask me, girl, to set you free, girl.
That's John Lennon singing Arthur Alexander's song, Anna, and we open with Arthur Alexander's recording of his song, which, of course, came first. Arthur, your reaction when you heard the Beatles?
Oh, I was really high on that, you know. I couldn't believe it because, see, at the time I heard it, the Beatles were selling records like hotcakes, you know. And the fact that they had recorded my song, I was totally elated, you know. I heard the cash register ringing, you know.
You heard it ringing, but you never got the money, as you explained to us during our concert.
No, I never got the money. But, I heard it. I heard it ringing, though. You know, I could hear it, you know. And I was, you know, like totally elated, you know, until I found out that I wasn't going to get the money.
And you didn't get it because?
Because the publisher didn't pay me.
Uh-huh.
See, I made a deal with the publisher. You know, I didn't have a publishing company. And so a song has to be published. So you have to have a publisher. So I made a deal with the publishing company that published the song, and they were in turn supposed to pay me half of the money that they got from the song. And they never lived up to their end of the bargain. They never paid me.
Did you ever sue them?
Yeah, I tried, you know. Matter of fact, the case is still going on some publishers, you know.
Now, the two songs that we both heard, You Better Move On and Anna, have a very similar theme, two men in love with one woman. I have to think that these songs probably had something to do with your own experiences.
They certainly did. They certainly did.
So what was your story?
Well, You Better Move On was a real life trauma between, you know, this girl that I had met out of high school and the guy that she had been going with all through grade school, you know. And I met her out of high school, and I thought we had a pretty good thing going. And since he'd been going with her through grade school and everything, he evidently thought he had the best hand. And so I put my feelings in the song. I never confronted him personally, but in song, you know, I did, you know, because that's the way I felt. And everybody knew that this is what was happening because people in the street, you know, they would tickle you, you know, about how's the relationship going. You know, they would ask me, and I'm sure they would ask him, you know. But I won out that little deal there.
So what was the outcome?
The outcome was I married her.
Uh-huh.
I married the girl, And the girl was Anna.
Her name was Anna.
Right.
So how long were you married?
We were married, I believe 8 years. Yeah. And then we were, separated. But we really didn't get a divorce, I think, until like 74.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're real good friends.
Let's get back to your singing. So you made your first record upstairs from the drugstore. Your second record was the first record that was ever made at the Muscle Shoals studio in Alabama. But you didn't stay there, did you?
No.
How come?
Tom Stafford was my manager, and he and Rick, you know, they had a falling out, and Tom wanted to move to Nashville because Dot Records had expressed an interest in signing us, and he wanted to pursue that.
So did you go to Nashville?
Yes.
Nashville is, you know, the capital of country music. You were always interested in country, and I mean, you're credited with one of the people who started singing a kind of fusion of country music and soul music. But how did you do in Nashville?
I started off doing quite well in Nashville. You know, I recorded Anna in Nashville. I recorded Go Home Girl in Nashville, and I recorded several other songs that I was pleased with, but after a while, you know, it became, everything got caught up in a business type of thing, and I don't think we were recording as good of songs as we should have been, you know, for my career.
Would they give you stuff you didn't like?
Well, they would, to give you an example. After You Better Move On hit and they needed an album, they picked a bunch of songs that was currently already out, you know, and said, we need this album, you know, and let's record this, you know, and these songs and put out an album. And I felt that we should have waited, you know, and tested the waters, you know, give me a chance to write a few more songs look around for some songs that was original, because the songs that we recorded had already been recorded by other people and were already hits by other people. And so that took a lot away from my album, you know, right there.
Was there anyone who watched out for you when you were getting started?
Well, Tom Stafford, but He became
he's the one who ran the studio, the Muscle Shoals studio.
He's the one that had the studio above the drugstore.
Right, I'm sorry. Right.
Yeah. So I mean, he was looking out for me at first, but then he got caught up in a bunch of stuff himself. So in the end, he couldn't even really look out for himself. So he wound up, you know, making a lot of bad deals for me and for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And but he was the one that got me started in the business, and he was the one that my loyalty was with. So I instinctively knew a lot of times that, you know, what he was doing wasn't quite right, but I credit him, you know, with getting my career off the ground. And so I followed him, I think, through a lot of bad relationships, you know, business deals that maybe I shouldn't have consented to.
Singer and songwriter Arthur Alexander is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Arthur Alexander. Bring us back to the period of the early 60s when you started to perform nationally. What kinds of places were you playing?
When I first started off, I was playing like dance halls, you know, and then it progressed down to, what they call like the Chitlin Circuit, you know, the one-nighter deals where you go out on the road on the bus, you know, and you play this joint this night, then you drive 500 miles and you play another joint, and you do that for like 2 or 3 weeks, you know, until you just you just wore out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you really, you have no recollection of those places, you know. Once you travel on a bus, you know, for 500 miles each way, you go on the stage and then you get back on the bus and you drive another 500 miles, and then you're lucky if you got time to wash up and change clothes and go on stage.
There was a period when you were playing a lot of the R&B shows, and I know one of your songs, Johnny Heartbreak, was recorded by Otis Redding, who was a friend of yours.
Right.
Now, from what I read, it sounded like you were supposed to tour with him on his last tour, the tour in which he was killed in the plane crash.
That's right, I was. I mean, you know, I had my plane ticket and everything, you know, and we had talked, you know, and Otis had said, he wanted me to open the show for him. And he sent me the plane ticket. I was supposed to meet him in Atlanta. But the night I was supposed to leave Alabama, it was a big fog there, and no planes were taking off and no planes were landing. So I missed the connection in Atlanta. So I called him, and he said, "Well, man, I got to leave, you know, so I have the ticket rewrote, and you can join me, you know, a week later, and it'll be, you know, basically the same thing." But a week later, he was dead. He had, you know, died in a plane crash.
Would you have been with him on that plane had you made your plane?
I probably would have. I probably would have been. Matter of fact, if I'd have made my plane, it's probably no doubt I would have been there. But I take that as, you know, as a blessing and a sign from God. I don't think he wanted me on that plane, you know.
You left performing after your recording of Every Day I Have to Cry. Now, this was a song you wrote earlier in your career. Steve Alemo had a hit with it in the 60s. You recorded it in 75. That, I think, reached the top 40 or top 50. Not too long after that, you left the recording industry. You explained to us during your concert that had a lot to do with the way you were treated in the music industry, the fact that you didn't make money for some of your songs, that you weren't treated well, bad business deals. Were there personal reasons, too, why you wanted to get out?
Well, the main reason, you know, after I recorded Every Day I Have to Cry, and it reached, you know, it was top 40 in 75, and I was informed that I wasn't going to be paid, you know, that was just the last straw, you know. You got a top 40 record, you know, and you're not going to make any money, then, hey, I mean, what are you in it for, you know? I mean, how can you go on after that, you know? So I just said, well, you know, forget it, you know. I'd rather pump gas, do anything, you know, than keep making records and not, you know, not get paid.
When you left music, you found God, but did you miss music?
I mean, well, I had music with me all the time. I sang in church.
Uh-huh.
Every Sunday I could, I was up there, you know, with the choir. I was singing my heart out. You know, I had programs, and, hey, I was loving what I was doing. I was singing for God, and he was putting melodies in my heart and my mind, and my spirit was flowing, you know, and I was feeling good. And I wanted to stay there, but, you know, but when you face the truth, you have to go back and straighten out all the little things in your life that you left that was wrong, you know. And I had some things that I had to go back and deal with. And God moved me on from there to Cleveland.
What was in Cleveland that you had to deal with?
I had a daughter and a girlfriend who I later married in Cleveland. And I had to get that together. So I was off to do that. And that freed me up, you know, more, you know, because I felt I was doing the right thing. And I was doing the right thing. And I had two kids that I had by Anna, and they were growing up. So when I got to Cleveland and got a job, I sent for them. And I brought my whole family together. And then we had another kid. and we kept growing, you know. So there you have it.
And you supported them with your job driving a bus for a community center.
That's right.
Were you writing songs during the period when you weren't performing? And if not, when did the first new song come to you?
The first new song. Wow. The first new song came to me like 2 years before I'd done the session, which was I Believe in Miracles. And that song just, you know, that was really played heavy on the decision to go back in the studio, because I believe God wanted me to go back in just to do that song, because, you know, it played so heavy, you know, on my mind, because I'd be driving the bus and I'd find myself singing that song, you know, before I even knew it was a song. You know, I'd just be singing, you know, and I said, wow, you know, I don't remember writing this song before. And then I said, wow, this is a new song. So, yeah, I think, yeah, 2 years before I done the session.
Well, I'm really glad we had this chance to talk, because as I said, when we did the concert, the only frustration was that there wasn't nearly enough time to hear your story. So thanks so much for being with us again, and I wish you the best with your new performing career and your new record.
Hey, thank you. Thank you very much.
Arthur Alexander's new album, his first in close to 20 years, is called Lonely Just Like Me. He starts a summer concert tour June 20th at the Central Park Summer Stage in Manhattan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.